The Enneagram, for a quick overview for you folks, is a theory or a teaching that they feel started probably maybe 2,000 years ago. They don't know for sure, but it was in a Sufi tradition, which is a monastic order in the Muslim religion. And it was basically used by the guru or the teacher to help his disciples discover their shadow side and to work with it. It has gone through different traditions. It finally became more public in the 40s. There was a Western teacher by the name of Gurdjieff, he's Russian, and he used it. There was a fellow from Chile who was one of his disciples, learned it, took it to Chile, and he had an institution there that he worked with people that were on their spiritual journeys. There were some Jesuits from around the Chicago area that took some courses from him, encouraged him to come up, and he stationed, I think, somewhere, I think he was in California around the Berkeley area, and then Chicago. The Jesuits in Chicago have used it, and they are now using it in one of their courses that they teach and help the different priests or whoever are interested in spiritual directorship. The theory is that there are 9 aspects of the Enneagram. In fact, there is quite a good drawing in the beginning of it here. It's in a circle, and there's 9 parts to it. And if you'll notice, it doesn't start with 1 because it isn't a hierarchy where 1 is better than the other. The reason for the numbers is so that there isn't a positive or a negative description for each part. And the theory is that all of these are a part of our personality, and the optimum health is that we are able to pull on any one of these segments given the situation that we're in. As a small child, usually between the ages of 4 and 6, we find one aspect from our temperament that works better in our family system than another for our own personal survival of our little psyches. Mm-hmm. And so we learn to fine-tune that, and we use that through our adult life, thinking that if it worked then, it'll work now. If it doesn't work, well, let's just fine-tune it some more, and then it'll work. And we keep enlarging on it rather than figuring out that, folks, this just doesn't work. We need to regroup, find out what will. And so we started out yesterday then. We explored the 8, 9, and 1, which the 8 being the boss or a total controller of every situation and of all the people in their lives. And then if they can pass through letting go and discovering that they are not totally in control, they can become the revolutionaries. And there's always the positive side of this as well as the negative. The important thing that we're trying to do is stress the negative, because that's our shadow side. That's the part that we deny that everybody else can see in us, but usually not ourselves. The sloth is the person who can identify with everybody in the situation, does not take sides, and kind of melts into the woodwork. They vacillate between who's right and who's wrong and can never make a decision for themselves. They're out of tune with their own decisions and their own personal theology, almost, it might be a way of saying it. They just identify with everybody else. The ones are the perfectionists. There's always room for improvement. One of the people that said in the group said that when she turned in her thesis, she had about 5 minutes before it was due, and she was looking through it, and then she asked the professor if she could take it back because there's one chapter that needed to be fixed yet. It's never finished. Perfectionists have a hard time finishing anything because there's always room for improvement. These, the 8, 9, and 1 are usually, if they're, when they get into a stress situation or a life-threatening situation, maybe that's a little strong, but their first reaction will be anger. Of either, the 8 will be fight, to lash out or control it with anger, intimidation. The 9 totally is out of touch. The 1 internalize it, beats themselves up. And part of being a perfectionist, you don't show anger. That's definitely a no-no. Today, in the announcements, they said that we were going to explore fear. But actually, what I had planned on doing and what I'm going to continue doing is we're going to be exploring those that have that use depression or submit. There's fight, flight, and we feel submit. There are actually three ways of handling aggression. And so today is the 2, the 3, and the 4. The caretaker, who is the external, will try to take care of their environment and then so that their environment will then take care of them. The performer, who is much more into image, they're totally out of touch with their feelings. And then the tragic romantic, who internalizes everything. So each one has an external, one that's out of touch, and then the internal, or the introvert, extrovert, out of touch, and the introvert. So what I've been doing is, on each one of them, I'm going to read some statements that identify with that individual, and then read some stories of individuals who have identified themselves that this is the where their gut reaction is when they're in a position. Okay, we're going to start with the giver or the caretaker. Many people depend on my help and generosity. I take more pride in my service of others than anything else. I need to feel important in other people's lives. I like people to need me. Many people feel close to me. I regularly compliment other people. I like to rescue people when I see they're in trouble or in an embarrassing situation. I'm almost compelled to help other people, whether I feel like it or not. People often come to me for comfort and advice. Many times I feel overburdened by others' dependencies on me. I don't feel that I have that many needs. I sometimes feel that others really don't appreciate me for what I've done for them. I like to feel close to people. Sometimes I feel victimized by others, as though I'm just being used by them. To love and be loved are the most important things in life. Emotional issues are important to me. I feel I deserve to be first in someone's life because of all I've done for them. I think of myself as a nurturing kind of person. When I have time off, I frequently spend it in helping others. I communicate with my friends more often than they communicate with me. I like taking care of others. The 2 was real hard for me to work on in public because I'm a 2. And now you're going to see all my good sides. Every time you talk to me, you'll wonder about my motivations. The 2's motto in life is to be needed. There is a tendency to think that I'm bigger than the world, that kind of a messianic tendency. My persona can change to other people's needs. I repress most of my needs. I have no clue that I have any needs. I take care of everybody else. I like to think I've moved beyond this, by the way, folks. helpfulness with manipulation is probably the key here. if I take care of you, then you will take care of me. One of the stories, or one of the analogies was, I'll put up my umbrella and put it over you and walk real close. Forever seeking approval. Will give expecting future payback. Manipulative. The stereotype is the mother who always brings chicken soup over. See what I've done for you, and this is how you're going to treat me? The power tool that givers use is seduction. In my own personal life, I was in a very dysfunctional situation at one point, and I've really given my all to it, to this business and relationship. And so somebody very matter-of-factly asked, well, why don't you get out? They need me. I can't get out. They need me. And this person very said, are you sure you've got that right? The challenge in my life has been to forego approval. In fact, I've taught my daughter, one of the things I've taught my daughter is to do things not for approval, because people will use approval to manipulate you. I for approval, there was amazing the number of things that I've done in my life to seek approval. And if I hadn't needed that approval, I probably wouldn't have done what I did. And to acknowledge one's own personal needs, to acknowledge my own needs and move in that direction, to not, to be cognitive of other people's needs and not push over top of them. But if it's cold in here, not to give up my sweater to attract you to me, to show you what a nice person I am, but to keep my own sweater on and keep myself warm. That person can take care of themselves. I'll take care of me. Famous twos are Mary Magdalene, Martha, the sister of Mary and Lazarus, and on the positive side, Mother Teresa. Here are some other stories of twos. I'm not alone in this. I was a helpful child who believed that my family was basically incompetent and needed a lot of support. So by taking care of my parents, I made them strong enough to take care of me. I got my parents to go to Sunday school, to Sunday services, because that it strengthened them, all the while knowing that I was Jesus' favorite in the Sunday school for bringing them to the faith. As an adult, there was a repeating pattern of giving myself over to a man, and by serving him, getting him to serve me. I would work and give him the money to support us so that he would pay my way. If I thought that I was actually taking care of myself, it felt like not being loved because I wasn't being taken care of by him. The first thing that I look for in a new place is who's the heavy? Who's got the power in the room? I do it mainly by hanging back until I see how people are responding to each other and it's clear to me who has respect. Once I know that, meeting them feels challenging. It's like everybody else went away. I get more animated and try for eye contact. And even if it's across a crowded room and I can't manage that, I feel that I am in a current of contact and I know if they're going to be available to me. It's the feeling that I am being drawn to them and they seem to be coming across the room, although they haven't moved physically at all. Secretaries are wonderful givers. I am a secretary. We are very intuitive to other people's needs. And willing, we give away our agenda for someone else's agenda. And I can do that now, because I know it's only for, that's why I say temporary services too, because I have to, it's a real challenge for me to stay in touch with my own agenda, with my own priorities. I can give until I'm totally empty of giving, and then I get incredibly resentful because it wasn't appreciated. A couple of days ago, I was walking down to the bridge, and I came back, and there was a little snake on the road. And there was the tire tracks. You could see right, it was laying right smack across the tire tracks. And I looked at it for a while, and it was sunning itself. It was in a wonderful place. But yet it was right, so I finally, and I thought, well, even if I left it and there's no more traffic for the rest of the day, and it'll eventually crawl off. At the same time, I thought, you know, a guest is going to come along, or a staff member that doesn't like snakes, and your life is in jeopardy here, folks. We've got to get you off the road. That's all there is to it. So I found a stick, and I got him on, I picked him up, and I took him over, and I found a nice sunny spot, and I put the snake down on that. And I was so proud of myself for saving that snake's life. It crawled off into the shade. You ungrateful. I'm still at it. So, does anybody else identify with the giver?
Does the giver tend to become a workaholic more than most? Perhaps the giver and the perfectionist?
I would say so, strictly because of being a workaholic, of going after the approval, working for somebody else's agenda, because if I do it well enough, probably if they're a workaholic, it's not on their own project. It would not be on their own project. It would be on a project of a somebody that they report to, or somebody that they're trying to impress.
Well, this is constantly being emphasized in our Christian teachings, you know, loving and serving others.
Oh, mm-hmm. Well, we're good. We're good little Christians. You betcha. We're nice too.
Well, I think women almost automatically fall into that tradition, particularly if you have children.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even if people don't choose that, if you're going to be a good mother, you become that. Or if you're going to be a good wife, or if you're going to, you know, if we're a lot of women are placed, maybe not necessarily by choice, but by tradition.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Being a giver is a very important part of living. The important thing to do is find out what is the motivations behind the giving. That what is the integrity in the giving? That's the crux of the matter.
And it seems to me in the case of children, that's true. There has to be a lot of giving in it, but maybe 20 years later, some of the mothers or dads will say, well, I raised you for 18 years, now why aren't you coming and visiting me, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, this is opposed to, well, that's my job. That was my job, is to care for them, and now they're on their own. And so they're, I think you can still be providing care for your children. That doesn't mean you're fit in that role necessarily.
No, not true. But I think in daily life, you do become a giver, oh. And it depends on how what degree you go mm-hmm. to it. And also, I think you can be a giver and do it joyfully, and have it received. And if you're doing this, you will get this return back from your children and whoever you're giving mm-hmm. to. It becomes a two-way street instead yeah. of you doing the giving and saying, well, where are my thanks?
That's
it. A two-way street, it's a different, it's mm-hmm. a whole different.
But there's an awful lot of parents who expect
right.
returns.
Mm-hmm.
I did that for you for 20 years. Mm-hmm. Opposed to, well, that's my job, and if I don't get something back, well, mm-hmm. I don't get mm-hmm. it back.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think of, what is that old thing, if they ask for your shirt, you give them your cloak.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If you're giving it to them because they truly need it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one thing. But pride is a biggie.
Yeah.
Okay. I am such a good person because I gave you this cloak. And one of the things that when they refer to the redemption of the two is when the giving is done without thanks.
You're describing all nurses, most healthcare workers,
mm-hmm.
whatever.
Definitely.
But you mentioned secretaries. I can share with you, my secretary is a child and alcoholic, and really fits that role, and I try not to abuse it, but...
And still, a good secretary would fit these roles.
Well, absolutely. I mean, she would be more inclined if, for example, I have work that needs to, that I want to get done, and it's 5 o'clock.
She'd stay.
Yeah, and I wouldn't even have to ask her, like, well, I can stay, you know, too, even if she's got to be somewhere else, you know.
Yeah.
And so there's a difference in how she perceives that. Or about the other secretary we had. No.
I have to say that at a point in my life as a secretary, I was in a small business, and I, at the time, had a daughter that was in fifth grade, and she'd been known to curl up on the floor with a coat for a pillow waiting for mom to make that last entry so we could go home. This would be like 8 or 9 o'clock at night. So it can get pretty dysfunctional. The next one is the performer. This person is out of touch with their feelings. Image is all important. Who I am is who I perceive you to think I am. Mm-hmm. Efficiency. Beth is a close friend of mine, has figured out that she's probably a 3, which is the performer. And I can see that in her when she's been working on her master's. In the process of getting her master's and getting the best grades that she could possibly get for her master's, her personal relationship went to pot. I've seen her work on things to the point where her health is gone because it's got to be done. There's been a time that perfectionism and performers are confused. The difference between a perfectionist and a performer is the perfectionist does it from internal standards that need to be met. Performers do it for approval, for external standards of who they then are. They get lost in the image. Okay. The statements that a 3 could be heard to say: I like to keep myself on the go. I like to work on a team. I make a good team member. Identify with precision and professionalism. Being able to get things organized and accomplished just seems to come natural to me. Success is a word that means a lot to me. I like to have clear goals set and to know where I stand on the way towards those goals. I like progress charts, grades, and other indications of how I am doing. I'm envied by other people for how much I get done. Projecting a successful image is very important to me. Making decisions is not a problem for me. To be successful, you sometimes have to compromise your own standards. When I recall my past, I tend to remember that I did well and right, rather than what I did poorly or wrong. I hate to be told something I'm doing isn't working. Generally, I prefer to be involved in the aspect of an operation that will get it moving rather than keep it going. I would do well in the advertising aspect of a project. I can get so identified with my work or role that I forget who I am. I believe that appearances are important. I feel I need many achievements before other people will notice me. I tend to be an assertive, go-getter kind of person. First impressions count. The 3's motto is, to be is to be successful. They feel that they're out of touch or out of sync with the world and need to adjust themselves to be noticed in the world. They're out of touch in regards to their feelings. They're willing to change their persona to meet the task that they're in. Winning is all important because people the world likes winners and are willing to win at all cost. Deceit is not unknown to a performer. They're innovators, and actually of all, around the Enneagram you will find that in one of the books it talks about physical appearance. They are the beautiful people. Perfectionism to gain glory. Their power tool is lying, even probably to themselves as well as to other people, but they are not usually... Beth was... She got to thinking about this perfection or this performance side of herself, and she remembers as a preteen her mother telling her what a good liar she was. And she took it as a compliment. It never occurred to her that wasn't a compliment. But they will avoid failure at all costs. The stories, the three, include... I can talk on the phone, feed my daughter, make an appointment, and listen to a conversation all at the same time, and track all of it. It's an extension of having two or three jobs going at the same time, so that there's always the next thing to go on to before you finish the task in hand. There is a real sense of security in having the time filled with no dead spaces. Relaxing has the purpose of getting ready for the next round. The hot tub is on the schedule because it saves my body, and while I'm in there, I get a tape recorder sitting on the tub deck and my mind on the next day, the next conference, and the next deal. If I'm cut off from the contact of people telling me how well I'm doing and there's no good feedback coming my way, there's a great temptation to run to the gym or run off to some place where there are people who will give me a little praise. I'm living in suburbia with my two sons and my part-time therapy practice. It's an ideal setting with what I always knew I wanted in life. It's difficult, however, to say what I'm feeling most of the time. What I'm aware of most is the appearance of things. Are my children clean and looking happy? Hard to just be with them and spend time without making everything into an activity. What I realize is that I'm cultivating the image of the perfect New Age woman, alternative therapist living with her sons in the suburbs. Feelings have always seemed incompatible with getting the job done. You can either sit around and be emotional, or you can get on with it. As a result, I've had a lot of people telling me that I step on them and that all I care about is their output rather than their feelings. I have felt that way when I worked with Beth. But then, I'm a giver. It's quite true in a way because I'm applying the same yardstick to them as I do to myself. It has, for example, been hard for me to recognize that other people slow down under pressure or they get disoriented and their private life isn't working out. When I try to stay with my own feelings, there's a sense of real confusion. Do I have the right one? How am I supposed to tell the difference between my own and the ones of my image thinks it should be feeling? When you've lived with your whole life fitting into other people's expectations and all of a sudden you get hit with your own experience, it can be alarming. Real likes and dislikes come up. You try to come up with a different barometer, how things feel rather than how they look. Focusing on yourself rather than others terrifies you because you don't know what you're going to find out about yourself, and even if there's anyone at home to find. The challenge for a three is to find self-value. The three is avoiding pain or avoiding their own feelings by doing, by being. They're not in touch with who they are because it's too all important to be who you think I am. And at that one point it said there that they went to the gym to find praise rather than fall back into being alone with themselves and getting in touch with that pain. They went looking for some praise, went out to do something. They're just totally out of touch with it.
Well, yesterday you also spoke about the fact that the three on the top are body,
mm-hmm.
right? And these three you're reading now are...
in the feelings.
Feelings. But they... I don't get the correlation because it doesn't seem like the top one... I don't know what they did with their body, how that was related. Like, how is this going to be the feelings? Because these people, they're working out of feelings.
Mm-hmm. Where the top three, they're doing, in a sense, the body, or in doing, is their way of relating to the world, where these three relate through feelings.
Okay.
Like the three said that they were accused of just stomping over top of other people to get something done without... They were totally out of touch with their own feelings. Maybe by explaining the four, then you can see the contrast between the three and the four. I don't know if it'll help. But
like two is too in tune with feelings. Three has no feelings coming.
Yes.
And four has what?
Well, the two is all their feelings are projected outward.
Oh.
They're not acknowledging their own. Where a three is. Feelings, but are totally out of touch with feelings. Where the four is the elitist in feelings. They feel that they have all the feelings and nobody else has any. moving on to the four, for that reason, a four is the tragic romantic or the artist. in one respect, when I think of the fours, I think of the Greenwich Village and the Bohemian coffee shops, the beatniks, the beatnik era. Or in a lot of sense, as I look at, when I drive down the streets, if there's a lot of young people hanging around, I would say probably a lot of, I think we've kind of moved on beyond it now, but the punk rockers, the ones that would wear safety pins in their nose or be totally dressed in all black, they're, to me, that they're the tragic romantics of our society now. Statements that the fours are apt to make. Most people don't appreciate the real beauty of life. I have an almost compulsive nostalgia for my past. I try to look casual and natural. I've always had an attraction for symbolism. People don't feel as deeply as I do. Other people often lack the capacity to understand how I feel. I like to do things properly and with class. My environmental surroundings are very important for me. I like the theater very much and fantasize myself as being on the stage. Manners and good taste are important to me. I don't like to think of myself as being ordinary. I can get preoccupied with suffering, loss, and death. I'm sometimes afraid that just my normal feelings response won't be enough. I seem to absorb rather easily most of the feelings of a group, so much so that frequently I lose a sense of where my own feelings leave off and where the others begin. I seem to be more bothered than most about the termination of friendships. I resonate with a tragic clown figure smiling through the gloom. I have been accused of being aloof. I find myself swinging back and forth between highs and lows. Either I'm very up or very down. I don't feel very alive when I'm in the middle. People have accused me of being overly dramatic, and they really don't understand how I feel. The arts and artistic expression are very important, for me as a means of channeling my emotions. As much as I want to kind of say, woe is me, at the same time, where would we be without the artists? They are the deep feelers. They are the ones that are able to express, either in theater, in painting, in so many different ways, what we feel inside and can't get in touch with. On the other hand, sometimes they're a real pain to be around. One of my very close friends is a four, and she is very much recognizing now that she's single and she's been through several relationships. The relationship she is in, she's never present to. She's always comparing it to the one in the past or what this one could be. It's mostly the ones in the past. She really wonders if she should have done something different because that was really, this one isn't as good as that one was. Or when she was planning a trip to Hawaii and she had it totally fantasized out, this romantic walks on the beaches. And I was really, really challenged her to let go of it. Wait till you get to Hawaii before you get there. Let your relationship be what it is, not what you fantasize it to be. We all have a little bit of tragic romantic in us, I'm quite sure. Oh, here's some stories. I asked my mother if she breastfed me, and she said yes, she did for a while. My guess is that I had satisfaction as a baby, and then one day it was missing, which is, incidentally, the same way that I feel treated by her. She's there for me, and then she's not. That's become my life stance. I was happy once. Where did it go? For my whole life, I've been searching for it. Where did it go? Yet when people ask what I'm missing in life and what is it I think I'm seeking, it doesn't place itself as seeking that thing or person or that money. I'm seeking for it, that feeling of connection with something wonderful that is always hidden and always out of reach. I'm still on the divorce that happened 18 years ago because my mind is dominated by the idea that I've made an irreversible error that has altered the course of my life. The feeling is that you've blown your only chance for happiness and you're desperate to pick up some thread of understanding so that you can get on a way. So you go over it and over it, trying to understand the intricacies of all the phases of what you've been through. What makes me so preoccupied with past mistakes that I've been oblivious to some really promising love affairs. It's like being a character in a story. A character who's been put under adverse circumstances. I'm in this world as an outsider and no one understands who I am, which makes me feel different and misunderstood. It also brings on a kind of contained desperation. Nobody gets me. I'm an outsider and therefore tormented by not belonging. But I'm also intense inside because I am tormented. I live at the outer edges of whatever human beings can stand in the way of feeling. I remain mysterious to myself, and I am absolutely different from anybody else. When a depression comes on, it replaces everything else that I have going. Life just stops. There is no point, no purpose, no hope. What I hold on to is the passage of time. Everything passes with time, and in time I'll be released, seemingly by just having waded it through. When you've been as confined by grief as I have been, your whole body feels as if it's being played by whoever you're grieving for. You literally give yourself over to be played upon by another person. After an experience like that, you feel like you've just recovered from a long illness. You appreciate small things like weather and the colors that you want to wear. You feel privileged to have lived out so much. Tragedy will set you apart. In some way, it will single you out because you've looked at death and survived. been there. And that's part of the Enneagram that we need to acknowledge, is we need to experience all of these things over and over again to be whole people. Christ was all of these things, and we are all of these things. The thing of it is, we get stuck in one role and continue to try to cope with our reality with just that one tool or through that one way. If you get stuck as a tragic romantic, where's life? I mean, you're in the past. Or as I was stuck as a giver, and a quote I came across as a giver was, if burnout occurs, bad motivations are getting their revenge. Anybody has seen themselves today besides me?
Ah. Several times.
Would you say that you would identify with more than one thing, and that maybe at different stages of life you feel more of one thing than the other?
I applaud you. Mm-hmm. That's, to me, that is the ultimate way of living. It's, like I said, it's when you get stuck in one phase and you don't move on.
And look at why you're stuck there.
Mm-hmm. It's usually from that behavior from the beginning. There is one of the things that I didn't do, that I wanted to do when I started, was in the beginning of reading, when I believe that only I can save the world, it is then I break peace. Help me to make peace. When I think that only I can run things best, then I break peace. Help me make peace. When I cling to feeling sad, alone, or misunderstood, it is then I break peace. Help me make peace.
A thought following up on yours is that another book that I've read, or a book I've read on Hero Within, talks about going around, but it talks about it as a cycle going, what they call it, up or down, but experiencing the same things in a different way. Like if you're a caretaker, nothing wrong with caring, but as you said, providing it from a different perspective, like, well, I want to do this, and this person needs that, and it's not that I'm looking for something in return. So mm-hmm. we experience the same roles, but in a different way.
Mm-hmm. I think, well, like for the tragic romantic, it's an important part of the grief process any time in life. Where a lot of us, as we get further down the road, the seven will avoid the four at all cost. And so never really gets in touch with their pain. You were asking me about the shadow side. In a lot of ways, I can see the seven being the complete shadow of the four, that there's that side that the challenge of everybody to get involved in. The challenge for a four is to live with contentment in the present. The fact that they're potentiators is because of their creativity and their sensitivity. Like I said, where would we be without art?
Mm-hmm. Well, you actually need, I mean, of course, nobody will ever reach perfection, but you need some of this to make life interesting. And we don't all want to be the same.
Yeah.
And it would be a really boring place if we were all the same. Mm-hmm. And like you say, you will vacillate between one area and the other at different times, but it's important not to get locked into one.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I just thought of an example. I'm sure there are many when you think of artists, but I read sometime in the last few months, I wrote from the National Geographic about Andrew Wyeth.
Oh, yes.
And he apparently, although very successful as an artist, had a lot of periods of depression, too. He wanted to be painting something other than he was painting. He was never satisfied with doing the kind of work he did, even though many people perceive him to be a real competent artist, genius. He wasn't painting necessarily what he wanted to paint. He wasn't satisfied with it. It was like, it was a real struggle for him.
And then some of the times, it's to be satisfied with what you are doing, too. And that's sometimes you have to sometimes reach.
Was he a perfectionist then?
I don't think he was a perfectionist, but he was, I mean, recalling the article, he was in this kind of depressed, I mean, state often at times. It was like black periods, and even though he was working, and actively working, he was just really feeling depressed, feeling that he wasn't, you know, doing what he was supposed to be doing or something. So I don't think he, I mean, he may have been that too, I don't recall, but that really wasn't the thing that was sort of running his life in that way, that was kind of overpowering for him. And of course, his children and grandchildren are also artists, so it's certainly there's a thread there.
Again, what we're discussing here is always the compulsive behavior, not the healthy, but the compulsive side of things. Did I see somebody?
Can you read a couple of people who were famous three?
Famous threes. Dorothy Day. She is, are you familiar with the Catholic worker? Okay.
I'm wondering if some of the televangelists fall in that category.
Oh, I would think so.
Especially.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a good example.
Mm-hmm.
Because often the appearance is very much a...
Yeah, very.
A variance from the reality.
Okay, famous healthy threes.
Well put.
The model of a redeemed three is Dorothy Day, the American saint of the 20th century par excellence. She was born in Brooklyn, the daughter of a sports writer, and was given a wholly non-religious education. Moved to Chicago. Dorothy's social conscience was awakened, and at age of 16, she entered the Socialist Party. She went on through a failed marriage and doing several things. The yearning for a spiritual community also led her to her own baptism. My experience as a radical and my whole political past led me to want to join the masses and to love and praise God. But even faith remained for her an irksome business, a loyal endurance without emotional impact. In 1933, in the middle of the Depression, she founded the Catholic Worker newspaper. The paper is leftist, radical, Antarctist, I have difficulty with words sometimes, pacifist, Catholic, and to this day is sold for 1 cent, and the very first circulation rose to 100,000. She's been commended by Cardinal Spellman, the enthusiast. She was quite active during the Vietnam War, things like that. But it's, again, that the motivation behind self-survival is moving beyond that, as far as a three is concerned. It's not doing it for the approval, it's doing it because it's there. It needs to be done. Well, not by a tube.
Maybe some political leaders, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Beth found that as she was going through the three, how she has always been so focused on efficiency. Efficiency at all costs. That was always a biggie for her. I think, let's see, famous fours, Marilyn Monroe, Joseph, Jacob's son, in the Old Testament. And they say Thomas Merton is a famous, is a four. The animals that are associated with the four is the mourning dove. For the threes, it's the chameleons. The two is the licking puppy. I can be cute as long as you feed me.
What are the animals for eight, nine, and
one? I would like to hear some speculation for those that we have now studied. What?
Lion.
Mm-hmm. The bull or the rhinoceros is what this particular book refers to.
Or maybe that squirrel is trying to kill him.
I didn't hear it. What'd you say?
That squirrel is trying to steal my breakfast.
Oh, boy, you talk about aggressive. That was incredible. Yesterday, Beth was saying that at coffee break, there was one of those squirrels that climbed up the cups and then literally jumped across to the table, nosedived right straight into the butter. Oh, that's aggressive. That's doing everything good. Famous ones would be bees or ants. Lucy Van Pelt, Charlie Brown's best friend and Linus's sister, would be a perfect one. And actually they say Martin Luther.
We were
talking about that.
I'm reading it, but the call
would be
what author said. He was a perfectionist. And,
yeah. would be a real good one.
What's the animals for nine?
Whales and dolphins.
Nine.
They are the peacemakers. They're peaceful.
Sort of the pot.
Mm-hmm.
Sloth.
Yeah, or the sloth.
And then there's a sloth.
Mm-hmm. Just hanging on the tree, doing nothing.
Yeah.
Famous nines are also Jonah. And on the positive side, Pope John the 13th. Was it 13th? 23rd? 23rd. Yeah, me and Roman numerals. Okay, let me close then with the third part of this prayer. Well, I think what I'll do is take the first three plus the three we got today. Repeat them again. Dear God, I am free because with your grace I know only you can judge, because only you have the perspective as well as the power to make an unjust world just. I can relax. It is not up to me alone. I am free because with your grace I know I am loved and I am a lover, because you have touched me with your love. I am free because with your grace I know I am part of your world and your process. I participate in your perfection. It is not up to me. I am free because with your grace I know it is you who saves the world. You save me. It is not up to me alone. I can relax. I am free because with your grace I know your world is unfolding according to cosmic laws. I can relax. I don't have to win at living. I am free because with your grace I know I can be intensely alive in the simple moment because you are in that moment. I can relax and let life be life. As your perfect model for us, Jesus, amen.